Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. And someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit.
Happy V-Day. A lot of words start with the letter V. Valentine's. Venus. Vajayjay. Which means vagina. Victory. Violence. Vengeance. Virus. Vault. And even vermilion. Well, there's a lot more than that, but we're going to touch on just a few of those V words for this V-Day show on Yin Radio. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and our theme today is V-Day. So let's start with the obvious, Valentine's. Installment number one is about the V that you might be expecting, and that is Valentine's and love. I asked a few people around town, how many times have you been in love? Now, it's important that you pay attention to the second set of answers in the coffee shop. Because I talked to these two women once in this coffee shop in this first segment, and then months later I caught them again in a group discussion, and you get to see how their answers compared. How many times have you been in love?
Oh, many. Gosh. I'd have to count. I'd have to start counting on my fingers. Lots and lots of times. Do you really want a number? No. No.
How many times have you been in love?
How many times have I been in love? Gee. You see, I look at love in a more of a subjective way. So I fall in love with animals all the time. Does that count? I think it should. So, therefore, I don't like to put a quantity to something so subjective.
Fair enough. We found running for office.
Can I dodge the question so well?
Well, I can't say that I didn't consider that.
Let's see, if we're going to say love as in love, lust, love type, I'm going to have to count. I'd say five.
Okay, you got that? Woman one avoided the answer, and woman two said five times. Now, months later, I met up with them again, along with another friend, over wine, and the four of us discussed the topic once again. So the new voices first, and then the two women who we just heard, woman one and woman two, in that same order.
We're ready.
So what do you want to know
from
me?
Let's see, we'll ask you, how many times have you been in love?
Oh! Like seriously? Or flattered? Like you know?
However you want to answer it.
Oh, okay.
Because that's a big question of how do you define it. Too.
Yes, exactly. All right. Only three times that were really important, but I tend to fall in love a lot, so I cannot count that.
That's good. Do you want to answer the question?
I feel that love is something different for each person, mm-hmm. and for each relationship that one has. And so I don't really think that I can quantify the times that I have felt that I loved a person. Like, there may be a person that I work with that I'm really mm-hmm. close with, and I just love them. I That's really, what I mean. Truly yeah. care about them, and I would give up everything I have to see that they were happy or successful or taken care of. And that's one part of love. But then there's like the lusty part of love that I think about, and I think, okay, yeah, I felt that, and I am too embarrassed to even put a quantity on that. Because I might sound like some kind of a fresh woman, but
fresh is okay.
Fresh.
You're just passionate.
Sweet hookerish. I don't know. Anyways, I look at that and I see the different different kinds of love, and I feel like the English language itself just doesn't have enough terms to differentiate between these kinds of love. And so I feel kind of sad about that, because I love and care about so many people, and yet it's hard to vocalize and describe that love. So, yes, I love often, I love a lot, I love many.
That's great. You haven't answered this question, have you?
I might have, but I don't remember what I said, so maybe you'll have me on there twice.
I would probably recognize your voice.
Well, then you can see if she's...
If I'm honest. It changes. I mean,
last
I agree.
It was only 2, and now it's 10. Yeah. What?
What's happened in a month? What do we say? Woohoo! I mean, I agree with you. Love is a lot of different things, but to me, in love is different than love. In love is passion, and that psychotic almost passion. Mm. And I'm trying to think how many times that is. Let me count.
Too many. Like 100.
She needs one more. She's counting on her fingers. She's running out of fingers.
I would run out of fingers.
Yeah, me too. I'm like, one.
Well, and I'm trying to think. Does it count if you've not been with the person?
Is that
yeah.
two?
Oh, well, then it's more than three.
Yeah, I mean, really, yeah.
That's like
true.
700.
I don't know.
No.
700. Yeah. 700 for sure. I don't even know if I know that many people.
I don't know, but, you know, I mean, there are a lot of people that I was like, I'd roll in the hay.
Yeah.
Rolling in the hay. Yeah. And going, what ways can I run into that person that doesn't seem scary? It's a little different, you know? Maybe you shouldn't put that on the radio. Okay.
I didn't get it, so you can tell it to me.
Okay, seriously, that one? That one? I would say 4.
You're younger than me.
Okay, you have one more.
I need one
just
more.
Just teasing. No, you have one more. I have 3.
You have 3?
I have 3.
You have
and
3?
And I have a lot. But that was my number when I first asked myself the question.
Yeah,
I said 3.
3.
Yeah.
But then I can also do the redefinition.
Exactly.
And then my favorite answer after I redefine it is
everybody.
Many, many, many.
Many.
Times.
But you see if even if we look at it in the passionate way, if that person at that moment had asked me to marry them, I would always have said yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh. And then how many? Would
and
that
then
be?
How many? Like 100.
Really?
I'm not kidding. I don't know.
Really? You would marry 100 people?
Many.
Wow. Many, many.
I am a
because
whore.
Because you're so passionate, and then it's like.
No, because I am a whore. I don't know. I don't really know.
No, I'm just different.
You know?
Well, the conversation did continue, but after that, it got even more personal, as talk about sex and love often does. So we'll go on to the next installment, and it's quite personal, too. It's about vibrators, yet it's also professional. Anna Maria Roque interviewed Kathy Sprague, the owner of the adult toy store Eclectica in Moscow, Idaho, about vibrators. an appropriate topic for this V-Day show. Chris Bideman, who works at Eclectica, also participated in the interview. Now, a warning, this report is a bit risque, but with frank and professional discussion about adult toys. So you may be not inclined to share this piece with the kids. Here's Anna Maria Roque's interview with Kathy and Chris.
Yes. Come closer. Come. La, 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 la. La, 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 la. Let's talk about vibrators. So how many states don't allow vibrators?
Last I knew, it was Alabama and Tennessee. Texas has very strange and restrictive laws, but they're just the two that have banned them.
But why?
I guess because human sexuality, especially women's sexuality, is very scary to some people.
So you said you can't sell them to minors? There's an age?
There is an age in Idaho to look at the product back here. I could pay a huge fine. They can go download porn all day on the computer, but they can't come back in the store and buy a vibrator. I would pay a larger fine selling a girl a vibrator than if I sold her beer.
Oh, that's odd.
Well, yeah, because, you know, you use a vibrator at the car right around a tree.
Yes, of course. Yeah. So how many different vibrators do you sell?
Thousands. We have probably about 30 basic models that we always try to keep in stock. But there are thousands on the market, and we're always bringing in new styles that are exciting.
Gotcha. So what would be your most popular item?
Recent years, it's been the Rock Chick. It's a higher-end vibrator. It's silicone. It's designed for both G-spot and external clitoral stimulation. You can boil it. You can autoclave it. You can throw it in a 10% bleach solution. It's medical-grade silicone, so it is non-porous. When you wash it, you're not trapping bacteria and soap in little microscopic pores. So it's a higher-quality item, definitely, on any sex toy. Go with silicone. Women also, you can ask them, are you looking for something penetrative? Are you looking for an insertion toy or an external, more direct clitoral toy? And women buying for themselves will buy something external. Men, 9 times out of 10, will buy an insertion toy. Mm. And that usually, to me, is indicative of poor communication. Women will go with the jackrabbit or the beaver, that's a combination of the two, or the rock chick, which is the G-spot and the external.
How do you make people feel comfortable when they come in here and they're all nervous and they're embarrassed?
It's easier if they're quiet and nervous. It's easier to set them at ease. If they're loud and giggling and being really stupid, that's more difficult for me personally to deal with. We have clerks who are better with the loud, nervous people. But, we just approach them and say, hey, if you have any questions, feel free to ask. We're here to help you out. And at this point, I think most people realize that it's very confidential. The clerks don't go out and say, hey, guess what Chris Bideman bought today?
Do they usually come in groups, or do they prefer doing it by themselves?
Most come in groups the first time, and a lot of the girls will come back by themselves to make a purchase. And the soccer moms come in groups and they talk to each other about their vibrators. And the soccer moms, the best toy parties that we do, in fact, are for the women that are a little bit older and a lot more comfortable with their sexuality. We had a carload. One of the moms was still sober, so she loaded everybody else in a minivan and brought them down directly to the store from the home party. And we had two women fighting over the last jackrabbit that we had in stock.
Wow.
The most basic vibrator is a single speed. It's either on or it's off. The next step is variable speed. So it's like turning the tap on full, or a little less. And now there are pulsation functions, there are, you know, ascending and descending forces. It's amazing what some of these toys can do, and the little electronic readouts. And
I had an argument once with a guy about vibrators, and he said that they're unfair because men can never live up to what these machines can do.
Well, you know, if a man is threatened by an inanimate object, he probably needs to start working on his personality. That's what I suggest to the gentleman in a little bit nicer terms. But a vibrator cannot make conversation. A vibrator cannot get up and make coffee in the morning.
Very true. Have you ever seen the Sex and City episode where, I forget who it is, Charlotte gets one?
The Jackrabbit intervention episode. Yep. Yeah, we actually sampled that in one of our radio ads.
Yeah. You do run ads for vibrators?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're usually fairly tasteful. The ad that I have wanted to run for years, they will never let me run on commercial radio.
Why that?
I don't know. They had a gentleman who owned a shirt printing shop years ago, and the ad started out, "Shirt printing, shirt printing, shirt printing." And I suggested that I wanted to run an ad that started out, "Butt plugs, butt plugs, butt plugs." And they thought that was inappropriate. I thought it would be funny, but you know, those two words together seem to make people nervous or confused. We've had people who have to ask what it is.
Oh.
And it's like, it's two words, put them together. What do you think it means?
Do you have anything to say about vibrators, Chris?
They're amazing. Everybody should have vibrators, I think. It makes people happier, and it makes not only single people but couples happier if they're willing to discuss their sexuality with each other. It makes a better foundation and more open to their options instead of limiting what they do.
Do you talk to a lot of men about vibrators?
A lot of men ask about cock rings because they want to start off slow. Yeah. They want to get something for their girlfriend, but they are a little intimidated, so something small involves the man tends to go over really well. That and strap-on clitoral stimulators. The idea that the man can have the remote control is very appealing.
Do you sell them mainly to women?
I would say the majority of the vibrators we sell to women. There are a lot of guys who actually are now coming in and picking something out for their girlfriends or their wives. And the women are more interested in value, and the men are more interested in price point. If you talk to a woman about phthalates, you know, carcinogens in a cheap vibrator, she's willing to spend a few extra dollars for something that's more hygienic and safer. And the men, if it has lots of bells and whistles and looks cool, that's the selling point.
How many do you sell?
Oh, wow. Sales, I would say, like, on our third best seller, we sell about 75 a year of that one particular model in that color. We sell hundreds of them.
Are color important?
Color is very important. The purple rock chick outsells the pink one probably 12 to 1.
Why is that? Personal preference?
Preference, and it's just a really nice shade of purple. It looks pretty. You know, the awkward Caucasian flesh tone is not a big seller, especially with women. Men will pick that up, but the women will go for a pastel or, you know, a vibrant color well before they go with the weird, not really flesh tone.
What's the craziest, like, vibrator you've seen that even made you laugh?
The candy corn.
It's weird. That was just the weirdest color combination.
There was one that, you know, the really nasty, cheap candy that you always leave in the bottom of the Halloween bag? It's like this awful mix of colors, and it's just blah. You don't even know what flavor it really is. We had one that was that color. It was the color of really bad Halloween candy, and it just hung on the wall.
So color does matter.
Color.
How about size in vibrators? Does size matter?
Size always matters in vibrators. You know, we have more requests for a smaller girth than a larger girth. Women have a much better idea of what they're looking for than men. You know, with the strap-ons for the het couples, when it's hubby's first time to bend over, they always buy something too large. If the wife comes in and picks it out, it's the right size. Guys have a tendency to be size queens, and that's an overgeneralization, but they will pick out something that's just way too large, and then the wife comes in and buys something smaller.
Gotcha.
Start small, work up.
They do that when they're buying something for the wife as well.
Mm-hmm.
They always get something that's way too big. I swear that's one of the things we say most, go smaller.
I think they wouldn't, because wouldn't that make them feel more intimidating?
I think there's something about it being so much bigger that it's clear that it's a toy, so it's not as much competition.
Gotcha. You know anything on vibrators, like history? Besides the fact that they were steam-powered?
Is that more steam-powered?
Well, there used to be the wood models, and that was when women had bouts of hysteria, and they would go to the doctor, and basically they would get a pelvic massage to give out the bouts of hysteria, and it was a vibrator, so they would go to the doctors to have an orgasm, so that way the hysteria went away. And that was hundreds of years ago, a couple hundred.
Well, the vibrator was invented to keep the doctor's hand from cramping, essentially. It sped things along.
Mariah Roque brought us that interview with Kathy Sprague, who owns Eclectica in Moscow, Idaho. Now, installment number 3 is going to stay on the risque side. It's about the Vagina Monologues, the play that's presented every year in towns and on college campuses around the country and around the world. This piece is about the college women who produced the Vagina Monologues this year at the University of Idaho. The play is sexy and funny, and poignant, and heavy, and dark. Now, if you've seen it, you'll know what I mean. But if not, consider yourself warned.
We're worried about vaginas!
I bet you're worried. We were worried. We were worried about vaginas. We were worried what we think about vaginas, and even more worried that we don't think about them. We were worried about our own vaginas. They needed a context of other vaginas, a community, a culture of vaginas. There's so much darkness and secrecy surrounding them. Like the Bermuda Triangle, nobody ever reports back from there.
This month, the University of Idaho Women's Center produced the 2009 Vagina Monologues, directed by students Kim Stoud and Serafina Richardson. Eve Ensler's Vagina Monologues are funny, sexy, and powerful, but mostly, the play is important. The Vagina Monologue sends many important, empowering messages in a highly entertaining and touching fashion. Sex, love, rape, birth, menstruation, mutilation, masturbation, and orgasms. The monologues undertake every issue related to the big V word. Vagina, that is. The award-winning play is the cornerstone of the global V-Day movement dedicated to stop violence against women and girls. V-Day is a catalyst that promotes creative events to increase awareness, raise money, and generate broader attention for the fight to stop rape, battery, incest, female genital mutilation, and sex slavery. Yin Radio was there to see what it takes to put on a performance of the Vagina Monologues. Coming soon, we'll air a radio documentary right here on Yin Radio. But for now, here's a preview of the big V word and the Vagina Monologues. First, let's meet the ladies. This is Serafina.
Music, 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 and lights. Let's do it again. Great, much better. Let's do it again. I don't know! Okay, so let's do it one more time. Good, good, much better.
Phew. She's the director.
I was having a cocktail with my friend Kim Stout, who was asked to direct it, and then she was saying she wanted help. And so all of a sudden I'm co-directing it and sort of took over somehow. I'm not sure how that happened, but yeah, it was a casual conversation that turned into a gigantic project, so it was by accident, but I'm an MFA directing student here, so it worked out.
And Kim Stout is the other director. But through the process of producing this year's Vagina Monologues, Kim ended up with some parts herself.
Is that
Did you plan on having a part in it when you started this?
No. Originally, I cast Serafina in the monologue I'm doing, and then she stepped in to help as, you know, assistant direct, and then it turned into co-directing, and then it turned into Serafina just helped me direct the show, and she said she didn't want to do a monologue, and it just made sense that, okay, then I'll do it. And it worked out. It's one that I really like, so.
Zina.
Hi, I'm Sina Zimmerman, and I am playing as the narrator. I love it. I get to use my very projected voice to carry on important tidbits of information, and I get to introduce the lovely monologues.
In hundreds of interviews with homeless women over the course of 13 years, only one woman was not sexually abused as a little girl or raped as a young woman. For most of these women, home is a very scary place, a place they have fled. The shelters are, ironically, the first places many of them ever find safety, protection, or comfort. This is a woman's story as she told it. What isn't in the story is the fact that this woman met another woman in the shelter, and they fell in love. And through their love, they both got out of the shelter system.
You were involved last time. What did you play last time?
I got to do the Coochie Snorcher That Could. I loved that.
You look sad. Did you want to do that?
I wanted to give someone else another shot, but I really fell in love with that monologue by accident. I was a little freaked out when I first got the monologue because a lot of the occurrences were similar to experiences that I went through my own, and it took a lot of contemplation and observation to bring myself to be comfortable with those experiences and to be able to pull out and put on a performance.
So you have kind of a personal take on why these monologues are so important.
Yes, yes. I feel that, you know, women are at a disadvantage, but we are, you know, making progress. And the reason why I keep doing the vagina monologues is because it's really, really important for me personally to let others know that if you had been in an experience like that, it's okay. And there is the ability to move forward and to embrace those experiences to enrich yourself.
Simone?
I'm doing the monologue called The Little Coochie Snorcher That Could. It's about a young woman who had a rough time growing up, and she finds her salvation in another woman.
Memory 13 years old. My coochie snorcher is a very bad place, a place of pain, nastiness, punching, invasion of blood. It's a site for mishaps. It's a bad luck zone. I imagine a freeway between my legs, traveling, going far away from here. Memory 16 years old. There's this gorgeous 24-year-old woman in our neighborhood, and I stare at her all the time. One day, she invites me into her car. She asks me if I like to kiss boys, and I tell her that I do not like that. Then she says she wants to show me something. She leans over and kisses me so softly on the lips with her lips and puts her tongue in my mouth. Wow. She asks me if I want to come over to her house, and then she kisses me again and tells me to relax, to feel it, to let our tongues feel it. She asks my mama if I can spend the night, and my mother's delighted that such a beautiful, successful young lady, young woman has taken an interest in me. Her apartment is fantastic. She's got it hooked up. The 70s, the beads, the mood lights, the fluffy pillows. I decide right there that I want to be very like her when I grow up. She makes a vodka for herself and then asks me what I'd like to drink. I say the same as she's drinking probably. She says she doesn't think my mama would like me drinking vodka. I say she probably wouldn't like me kissing girls either.
This is the second production that I've been involved. I think that it's a new take on a classic piece that we've done every year, and I think this is the first way I've ever seen it done this way, so it should be exciting.
My name's Anna Marie, and I'm doing Reclaiming and the Woman Who Liked to Make Vaginas Happy. I play a dominatrix who is fascinated by being able to make women have orgasms. It's very fun.
It takes a lot of confidence to do this on stage.
I don't know. I've been doing theater for a long time, and I think that you just kind of have to own it and have fun with it. And if you love what you're doing, people respond to that. I mean, it's a pretty non-judgmental setting, so it's really no need for fear.
But I became obsessed with making women happy. I got very good at it. Kind of brilliant. It was my art. There was nothing like this in tax law. And I hated those blue corporate suits. Although I do wear them now in my new line of work from time to time, and they serve quite nicely.
My mom would probably come if she were here. My dad would be embarrassed to see me do it. But they're supportive.
I'm Rose Kinney, and I do the My Angry Vagina, and I'm also a part of the sex worker.
My vagina's angry. It is. It's pissed off. My vagina's furious, and it needs to talk. It needs to talk about all this shit, and then it needs to talk to you. I mean, what is the deal? An army of people out there thinking up ways to torture my poor-ass, gentle-loving vagina. Spending their days constructing psycho products and nasty ideas to undermine my...
Tell me about the orgasm piece. How do you prepare for that? And how do you do it with a straight face?
I don't. I laugh throughout the entire thing. I saw a lot of the vagina mods last year, so a lot of what I'm doing is kind of based off of that. But yeah, a lot of it's just kind of the first thing that pops into my head.
You have no inhibitions once you get on stage?
No, I did improv, like comedy improv, a couple years ago. So I've kind of learned that the more of an idiot you look like, the more funnier it is for the audience. So that's kind of what.
So if your mom, is your mom coming to see this?
No.
what would she say if she did?
I think she'd be supportive of it. She's always told me, Rose, it's a white man's world out there. And so you gotta, you know, take space and be a woman and, you know, fight against, you know, the patriarchal system. So it's like, okay, she definitely would support it.
Having seen performances in the past, I knew that this year's production was different. It was more intense as well as more risque. So I asked the ladies what they expected the audience reaction to be.
I think it's going to be a shock for a lot of people, but I also think that, you know, the show has been going on for a number of years now, so most of the people who come see it in general have seen it before. The number of people who've seen it before is much bigger than the people who haven't. So I think that they're excited, you know, it'll be exciting to have a new take on something that's kind of now becoming like a cult classic. So to be able to do something different, I think they're going to like it. Serafina has been a lifesaver. Like her... She's actually a directing MFA, so her experience has been really helpful. Most of it, I think, was discovered organically, like just through playing with it and deciding what can we do to make it different, what can we do to kind of sex it up a little bit. It's really been a collaborative show between everyone. So I think that's, the ideas just kind of happened. We didn't really plan it out. We made the orgasm one interactive, and so we thought we needed a through line with that, so we thought we'd do another one, and it's perfect because there are narrative lines that Simone says, and she said to me, so we thought we'd have somebody interact with her and say this to her, and it just kind of realizes it a little bit more. It's risque anyway. I don't think it's any more in the actions than already in the words, so hopefully it accentuates it and it sexes it up a little bit. But it's hard to get a new take on something that's been done so many times, so if that's new, then I say let's go for it.
Like I said, it adds a different spin and a different flavor, and that's what's beautiful and fun about the vagina monologues, is because like with every different cast, you know, you get like a different emphasis and a different spin.
Each year, V-Day focuses on a specific group of struggling, courageous women in the world. This year, V-Day Spotlight campaign highlights the atrocities being committed against the women and girls of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where rape is used as a weapon of war to torture and humiliate women and girls. In this year's production, the directors decided to show a clip at the end of the play to visualize the atrocities happening in the Congo.
You know, people are often afraid, I think. I saw some people just watching it in this room today that couldn't watch it and were looking at the floor instead. So these are women that are involved, and it is tough to watch something like that. And, you know, we see the Save the Children videos and turn it because of guilt. And so to have this kind of in your face and not be able to wiggle out or change the channel, I think it'll make a lot of people uncomfortable. But I also think it's a reality, and it's important to get exposure. And if it's doing it in this medium, it's what the vagina logs were meant to be, and I'm really glad it's finally being punctuated with something so powerful. I appreciate that
there's still theater for a cause happening instead of just, you know, light Lion King type stuff. Not to say anything against Lion King, but yeah, that there's still purpose involved. And it's one of the only shows I've seen in this town absolutely sell out from, you know, front to back of the audience. So I think that it's doing what it's meant to do, and that's creating awareness about violence against women. And it's still just selling out every time, and I think that's amazing. So it's doing something right, so I really respect it.
I appreciate it. I had no idea of the type of systematic tactics that were going on. It's very shocking, and I feel that it needs to be known. I thoroughly believe that if all of us, like, were aware of the situation, you know, I feel that that would empower, you know, those women to, like, have the strength to overcome, and hopefully for those for the government to step in. And I'd like to thank the Women's Center for putting more of an activism part in it.
And that is a taste of the radio documentary that Anna Maria Roque is making for us about the vagina monologues. This is Yin Radio, and today is the V-Day show. Now, the next one is something completely different. And we leave the area of risqueness behind for a moment. Well, for the rest of the show. Peter Chilson has a history of mishaps with libraries. In the sixth grade, he got caught stealing books from the library. Now, the following excerpt of an essay is from an essay he wrote about a library mishap in Africa only 2.5 years ago. The essay is called Romancing the Archivist. And if you're wondering how this piece fits into today's V-Day theme, expand your mind and think of the archives as the vault. It's a great V word. And, of course, the title, Romancing the Archivist, as a Valentine's topic. Or you can just not worry about the V-Day stuff and just enjoy the piece.
Before I begin, I feel I need to confess something. When I was in sixth grade, I got caught stealing books from the school library. And I've had problems in libraries and archives, and this is about a problem I had in an archive, a national archive in West Africa 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. The essay, I'm just going to read a piece of it. It's called Romancing the Archivist. Aliang Goiba studied me, tapping a pen on his desk. I wasn't too worried, though he'd accused me of spying in the National Archives of Mali, a gleaming white three-story monument the size of a city block, finished thanks to the benevolent generosity of Muammar Gaddafi, Africa's self-ordained guide. I did not fear deportation or worse, not in Mali, one of Africa's newest democracies, and an open, friendly country, easy to get around. But I wasn't sure if I was free to go or if I'd have to negotiate. I had with me a government research authorization marked by my photo and signature, a paragraph in French describing my project, and an orange stamp fixed to the right, top right-hand corner to prove payment of the documents tax. I'd spent a day traveling the city in and out of ministries in search of that stamp, and a week collecting the other components for this license to gather information, which I had laminated against the heat, the dust, and the touch of hands. I climbed the stairs to Ngoiba's second floor office. He is Mali's chief librarian and archivist, and he greeted me in the gray short-sleeved tunic and trousers of a government functionary, and he offered me a chair, some strong sweet tea, and asked about my family and health. He took my authorization, clipped between thumb and forefinger in his right hand, and while holding a shot glass of tea in his left, he sat back and behind his desk and began to read, grunting softly and frowning appropriately. He slurped his tea and moved his lips while he read. The office had no air conditioning, and the ceiling fan did not work. Sweat stained his tunic up the front of his chest. Finally, he smiled as he pushed the document back across the desk. I moved to shake his hand, believing I would soon be among the papers I sought. I started to tell him that I'd been in archives across French West Africa and in France, and that I'd found hand-drawn maps by district officers passing references to border points in official reports, contradicted by other hand-drawn maps and other scraps of paper. An interesting story on a continent pockmarked by failed states. But Ngoiba did not offer his hand. He clasped them together, elbows on the armrests of his chair. "Obviously, you're a spy," he said. I sputtered, but I have an authorization approved by the minister." He interrupted, persistent with his smile and accusation, "You work for the Senegalese, or maybe for Burkina Faso?" I stared back and uttered one word, "Senegal?" I laughed and instantly tried to suck the sound back down my throat. Ngoiba dropped his smile. "What are you laughing at?" he said. I'd come here with something to prove, and that was that borders of French West Africa are mere lines on paper, illusions of nationhood with little supporting paperwork. The archives could help me understand how France drew Mali's borders and those of its seven neighbors, all colonies, until the early 1960s. This was a starting point, I thought, for explaining Africa's endless cycle of war, and maybe for exploring ways to rethink nationhood on a continent of 54 countries, divided by 177 arbitrary lines drawn by men who'd never set foot on African ground, the legacy of the European scramble for Africa at the end of the 19th century. Lord Salisbury, the Prime Minister who oversaw Britain's role in the scramble, said over cocktails in London in 1898, quote, "We have been engaged in drawing lines upon maps where no white man's foot ever trod. We have been giving away mountains and rivers and lakes to each other, only hindered by the small impediment that we never knew exactly where the mountains and rivers and lakes were," end quote. Ali Ngoiba has been keeper of the archives since the time of General Moussa Traoré, who ruled Mali for 23 years behind a careful facade of noble strongman with a Marxist flavor until he was toppled in a bloody coup in 1991. I had a plan for Ngoiba, a rotund, handsome man with thick graying hair and high rounded cheekbones. Ngoiba seemed uninterested in my apology, but he did want to talk, and I knew I'd better listen. Leaning forward, he whispered to me, "At this moment, two army officers from Niger are here to look over documents about their border with Burkina Faso. There is gold on that border, you know." He nodded at the door behind me, and for some reason he lowered his voice. "They're in my reading room down the hallway." He looked at me as if to be sure I'd heard him. Then he added, "Mali fought two border wars with Burkina Faso, you know." The two wars concerned a 100-mile-long chunk of border called the Agache Strip near the Dogon country, some 300 miles north of the city of Bamako, Mali's capital. Both sides valued that region for natural gas and uranium. "Mali took the day both times, as I recalled." I said that to Ngoiba, trying to be conversational and pro-Mali. "No," he said, "we took nothing." But Mali and Burkina Faso share close tribal ties, their border being an arbitrary European thing drawn on maps, but poorly marked on the ground, if at all. They declared a truce. A few weeks later, they signed a world court proposal that settled the border for both sides. The resource promise of the Agache Strip never panned out anyway. I visited the old war zone a few days before I met Ali Ngoiba, driving north up the border in a Toyota Land Cruiser pickup. I'd hitched a ride with two Malian guys named Jean and Isaka, who were delivering the payroll for village primary schools on the Malian side of the border. For 2 days, we zigzagged the border, handing over wads of West African franc notes to schoolmasters, and drove to the next village across trackless desert, unsure of which country we were in. We never spotted an official vehicle or man in uniform, but I was nervous. My travel papers were for Mali, and instinct told me it wouldn't be good for an American caught illegally in Burkina Faso or any other African country in a remote border region, especially given what we were doing with our evenings, driving around and blasting away with a shotgun at anything that moved in our headlights, preferably rabbits. Jean held the gun out the window with his left hand, his right on the steering wheel. Isaka spotted targets. Oui, là, non, là, à droite, à gauche, there, near the bushes. I sat between them with my head back so Isaka could grab the wheel, letting Jean reload and fire away with both hands on the gun. Don't worry, Isaka shouted. We do this all the time. I tried to tell Ngoiba my story, hoping it might be worth a laugh and let him know that I'd been on that border, that I'd done my research and earned a look at the archives. But he shook his head and cut me off. It's old news, he said, waving his hand. We're all friends now. Right, I smiled. But you think I'm spying for Burkina Faso? He nodded and reminded me of the Nigerians in his reading room. An official Burkinabe team was here a few weeks ago, he said. Both governments are sending people to the archives all over West Africa to find anything they can to prove their case about where the border is or where they think it should be. He paused and looked at me. Then he said, last year, we caught a Frenchman trying to take documents concerning the border with Senegal. He was a history professor. I see, I said. We looked at each other for a few seconds. What did you do with him? With who? He said. The Frenchman. He just smiled at me. And it goes on from there.
That was Peter Chilson with part of an essay called Romancing the Archivist. This essay is part of a book project about borderlands in Africa that's called We Never Knew Exactly Where. Peter teaches writing and literature at Washington State University. And by the way, he did get into the archives there and has become great friends with the archivist. Now it's time to wrap up this Yin Radio V-Day show by going back to basics, Valentine's Day. Here's Anna Maria around town with the question, what's the best or worst Valentine's Day present?
What is the best or worst Valentine's Day present?
Ooh, a candy card. A candy card's the best when you write out a card with candy bars. So you can say, you are my sweet tart, and you're such a big hunk.
Oh, except for big hunks are gross.
It's a bit cheesy.
Yeah, but Valentine's Day is cheesy. Why should America or corporations tell me when I can celebrate my love?
True.
What about you?
Oh my gosh, I just had... My roommate was actually telling me a story about how some of her friends got married a while ago and, like, they were celebrating their 5-year anniversary on Valentine's Day, and he didn't tell her, and she ended up... She had a tattoo lock on her, so I can't remember where she said it was, but... And he surprised her and got a key, and she loved it. Like, and they're definitely the type of people that, like, this wasn't, like, a cheese ball or, like, you know, it actually was, like, very, you know, meaningful for them. So I think something where, like, you can... Where it's, like... Completely personal if you're going to be cheesy about it, assuming you have a boyfriend to give something to.
Vampire.
I've never gotten a Valentine's before.
Have you given any?
Just Valentine's cards. But for my boyfriend, I'm going to make him brownies and shape them into hearts.
Cute.
And then I made my own Valentine's card.
Oh, what does it say?
We've only been together for like 3 weeks, so it's just really like cute.
Okay, I think the best gift is flowers, because if they know what kind of flowers you like, you just enjoy them for as long as possible, and they're pretty, and they're sweet. And
do simple. You, like, dry them and hairspray them and put most in them?
I don't hairspray them, but if it's lavender, I dry them because I love lavender. The worst gift is an exercise video, and I know somebody who got one.
Is that like a celebration for a
guy? Someone who needs to die.
Oh, wow. That is harsh.
Flowers are cool as long as they don't just get you the typical, like, it's, I don't want your Valentine's Day special bouquet, you know, like, you know, I want some thought into it. I was like, give me one random flower as opposed to, like, a dozen roses.
What is the best or worst Valentine's Day present?
I don't know, that's one of those things you gotta think about, because I always want to go to evil, you know, practical joke stuff.
You know what my favorite
I once had a person give me one red rose, one white rose, and then wrote this little thing that said, the red is for passion, the white is for truth, what else do we need in life? Truth and passion.
Nice.
Isn't that great?
See, that's cool,
that's
though.
Clever.
That's actually really cool.
She was
really
an idiot,
cool.
though. Who could maybe write a good line or two? Whatever. Full of
Ray Guntrup and Tina May in the show for us with their song called Is It Love?
That I get inside the moment when you first walk in the room. Can it be your love's creeping up on me? I feel to wake and shake, cause I can't hide. Love passes but once, they say, but could someone take love away? Is it love? The draw's ever closer now. Saddest song. Thank you.
Thanks for joining me for this Yin Radio show about V-Day. If you want to hear past shows or podcast this show, you can do that at yinradio.org. And that is where you can sign up for our electronic newsletter to find out what's going on and what's coming up at Yin Radio. You can also find Yin Radio on MySpace and on Facebook. Let me know what you think of Yin Radio, for good or for bad. What would you like to hear more of? Or what do you want to hear less of on the show? What are we missing that needs to be covered? Drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio, Y-I-N radio, at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Next week, we're going to celebrate that spring is coming just around the corner with a collection of stories about being outside, specifically about camping. It comes from a women's wilderness and writing clinic, a trip that included writing practice and advice, and backpacking. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation. I'm your producer and host, Sandy Billings, and I'm glad you joined me. Until next week.
Can it be your love creeping up on me? I feel awake and shake, 'cause I can't hide. Love passes but once, they say. But could someone take love away? Is it love that draws us ever closer now? The heat that beats so sweet, your saddest song. The heat that beats so sweet, saddest song. The heat that beats the sweetest, saddest song.